Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Did you know that on an average day in Tulsa, 60 people will dial 911 to report an incident of domestic violence? We all know domestic and family violence are a problem, but many of us have no idea how our medical and social service agencies handle it. Enter Tulsa's Family Safety Center. Originally a program of domestic violence intervention services, the Family Safety Center spun off as its own 501c3 agency in 2006 and has seen dramatic increases in client traffic over the last several years at its current location in the Police Court Building in the Tulsa Civic Center complex. People who call the police about abuse are referred by law enforcement to the Family Safety Center, where a number of legal, medical, and social services can be deployed to help a victim achieve a feeling of safety, from an emergency protective order to documentation of physical violence and referrals to safe, confidential emergency shelter. Suzanne Stewart is the Family Safety Center's executive director, and earlier this year she received a Pinnacle Woman of the Year award from the YWCA for her commitment, dedication, and leadership in her field. Prior to her current role, she served the Tulsa Regional Chamber for 3 decades, eventually becoming executive director of its Visitors and Convention Bureau, where she had a big role in the original Vision 2025 bond package and helped champion the building of the BOK Center in downtown Tulsa. She also founded the Tulsa Sports Commission. Suzanne Stewart, executive director of the Family Safety Center, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Welcome to the program. Tell us about the Family Safety Center. When did it start and what's your mission?
We started in 2006. Tulsa was one of 15 cities who were the original grantees of an award from the Violence Against Women Act under President George W. Bush. And it was to establish a family justice center model in the country. There were 15 grants awarded, and it's based on a very successful model of co-located multidisciplinary services in one location that was started in San Diego in the late 80s. And so fast forward that to 2004, when the grant is issued, the feds have fallen in love with the program. The guy who founded it, named Casey Gwynn, went on the Oprah show, got him an entree into the presidential office, and it's all history from there. So the center opened in Tulsa in 2006, and we've been around since that time, and we're providing services to the families and victims of intimate partner violence, domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and harassment.
So you mentioned these co-located services, and so let's walk through it. So let's say someone comes in, and I looked at some of the numbers, but most of the clients are women, but there are a significant number of men too, but the majority women. So a woman comes in, say with or without a child, and says, I've been abused. You know, where do you go from there?
Normally what happens, 83% of our clients come into the center as a referral from law enforcement. So what will have happened is I'm beaten up by my perpetrator, and I call 911, the police show up. By statute, they're required to do a very basic danger assessment and to offer you services in addition to investigating and recording the case and the incident that happens. And so you'll be issued a police report. You'll be given a folder that says, and they tell you, we want you to go down to the Family Safety Center first thing in the morning, and we want you to talk to an advocate and to file for a protective order if you feel you need it, but you should probably go in and see these people for services. So the next morning, folks will come in. You may or may not be dragging a child. You may or may not be female or male. 22% of our clients are male and have a variety of different issues going on, but you'll come in, have a very quick intake with our specialists at the front that get some very basic data from you. Then we hook you up with an advocate who helps you if you are going to get a protective order through the protective order process and helping you file your documents, making sure that you've crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's in the petition with which you're filing for the order. And then while you're there, you can meet with a forensic nurse who will document injuries. You can meet with an attorney if you feel like you will need one to hear your protective order case in court, or if you want to file for divorce or guardianship or any other type of civil law issue related to your family and your case. We have a child therapist there who can actually work with your children while you're doing your adult work of filing for a protective order or going to court for your hearing or meeting with your attorney or the nurse. The child therapist can meet with your child and do some very basic assessment with them in terms of how they have perceived and have worked with the trauma that they've experienced. So there's a wide variety of services from as many as 13 different agencies who are on site who can help you work through those issues that you have. And whether or not you choose to get a protective order, it doesn't matter. We're there to help you. The point is that nobody deserves to be hurt, and we're there to provide a resource for you regardless of where you are in your process of wanting to leave or not wanting to leave.
So let's explore a protective order for a second, because it's something I think we hear about a lot and is a fairly, the concept is pretty simple, but what goes into the calculus of someone deciding whether or not they want a protective order? And then secondarily, is there ever a circumstance in which someone wouldn't get a protective order, get one issued, granted?
Right. Okay, so there are three scenarios that could possibly happen. People want protective orders for different reasons. Emergency protective orders, which are only good for 2 weeks. And then you have to go to court and go to trial for the permanent protective order that would be in place for 6 months to 5 years to a lifetime. But the point is that the incident must have at least made you feel like you were in imminent danger of injury, physical injury or emotional injury, that there is evidence that you were willing to testify about by signing your name to the petition, that this is true and honest occurrence, and I really am in fear for my safety and the safety of my children. In our process in Tulsa County, if you come to the Family Safety Center and you are a victim of intimate partner violence or family violence, which means the person who has abused you is related by blood or legally, or an ex-relation. It could be an ex-boyfriend, ex-spouse. It could be an ex-girlfriend. It could be a son or a daughter or a parent abusing an adult child, a vulnerable adult situation. That's the caveat for being able to really get protective orders in terms of keeping yourself and your family safe. Harassment, sexual assault are also grounds for that, and stalking, but you have to be able to articulate within a certain amount of space on this piece of paper exactly what happened to you and why you feel like you're in fear. Once that happens, then that piece of paper is relayed to the courthouse where a judge will review it. And because you're not going in front of a judge, that judge, Sarah Smith, who's been doing this for now 4 years, I think, every single day of the week, which has got to be a tough job, but she reviews all of these affidavits. And based on what you put within the four corners of that document, that written document, she's going to decide whether this reaches the level of seriousness that it warrants an emergency protective order. Most often, the judge will not require the depth of proof that would be required in a court hearing. It's the amount of evidence that is needed to show that there has been some kind of threat and that you really are in fear. And then the hearing is held later to give the defendant an opportunity to state their case of why it was not abuse, why this should not be occurring, and for the plaintiff, who would be the victim in the case, to be able to assert why this is important, the evidence is there, and I am still in fear of my future with this person. So the judge has that one opportunity to say yes or say no. Now, normally, if a judge says no, it's because there's not enough evidence there. It may be an event that may have happened 6 months ago that the person just now feels comfortable about coming in and reporting, but it's been so far in the past, it's going to be hard to make a case to continue it. So in that case, it might not be granted, but we have about a 96% approval rate, grant rate for the emergency protective orders. Now, the other thing may happen is that you may come in and say to the advocate who's working with you, I want a protective order. I've got to have a protective order. I don't feel safe. And in doing the danger assessment, that is a research tool that we use to measure lethality factors that are currently going on in the relationship. And there, each of these 24 factors are weighted scores. So if you have a 35 and it's these four questions that you answer yes to, you're probably not in a real good relationship, and you're probably not going to make it if you don't move on to someplace else safely, right?
And these are questions like, have you ever been choked or
are
there weapons?
Have you been strangled? Are there weapons in the house? Have you been assaulted? Have you noticed an increase in the violence of the incidents, you know, what is the time frame for all of this? So if you have a really bad danger assessment, two things may happen. You may go ahead and file for a protective order, but you get yourself to a safe place real quick before the defendant can be served with this petition. Or we work with you to develop a safety plan that will keep you safe, because by leaving, you might further inflame the situation and cause more harm against yourself unintentionally by trying to leave. Because statistics show us that the most dangerous time in a relationship is normally when someone's trying to leave the relationship. And that's when the perpetrator will take extraordinary means to either keep them there or in their life, you know. So in that case, we do extreme safety planning, and we come up with a way to keep you safe, give you the tools that help you develop the tools that you need when you're ready to leave, whether it's making sure you know where your driver's license is, your kids' stuff, your any of the identification materials, your medications, credit cards, cash that you've got on hand that you can use if you need to get away very quickly and in a time frame that you're comfortable with. So I think the important message out of all of this is that just because you come to the Family Safety Center doesn't mean you get a protective order. It doesn't mean you don't get one. It doesn't mean you need one, or it doesn't mean it's the time for one. Nobody's going to force you to take steps in a situation that may not be the best for you right then. And our role is to help you figure out what that is.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today, Suzanne Stewart, Executive Director of the Family Safety Center. One thing I'm curious about, protective orders, how protective are they? That is, how is it enforced? Because, of course, the police are busy doing a lot of things. And, in fact, I saw some numbers that you guys put out. On an average day, 60 people will call 911 just in Tulsa to report an incident of domestic violence. So all of those have to be investigated, at least, right?
Well, last year, I think there were 24,000 911 DV calls. Okay, 24,000. So that means an officer responds to all of those calls. Now, depending on what that officer finds when they get there, there may or may not be a case to follow up on a domestic violence incident or an abuse incident. And so they will write their report, and those reports all go into the central clearinghouse at the police departments, who then distribute those to their investigators. And there's normally a chief investigator or a sergeant or a high-ranking officer in the department, whether it's Tulsa Police or Broken Arrow or Sand Springs or Owosso, because we serve all of Tulsa County. Whoever that officer is, lead officer is, they will then distribute those cases to their detectives to actually do the follow-up work. So they'll meet with victims. They'll talk with the alleged perpetrator. They'll talk with witnesses that may or may not be at the scene or involved somehow. And they will come up with whether or not there are grounds to file charges, what the evidence is for those charges. And then once that is determined, then that case is forwarded on or not forwarded on to the DA for consideration for prosecution. And then that's a whole other process that takes place. But in our case, our family violence unit detectives, we have two officers, a sergeant and a corporal, and then five detectives, all seasoned, wonderful, wonderful investigators who handle anywhere from 150 to 180 cases each per month.
Say that number again.
150 to 180 cases each per month.
Whoa. And I was looking at your numbers. I mean, it seems like over just the last 3 years of numbers, there are more cases. I mean, is that true? So why?
Why?
Yeah.
You know, we're asking ourselves that too. Two things happened in 2013 when we moved down to our location in the police courts building from 31st and Harvard, where we were located. That changed the dynamic of who felt comfortable coming in. It was a much bigger facility. We're in the police courts building. There's a great deal of security that's built into that environment. And so that makes people feel a little bit safer. Hmm. The second thing that happened is that we changed the court process. Normally, when you would file for a protective order, and you still can do this, you can go to the court clerk's office on the second floor to the clerk's area, the staffing area, where you file all of your legal documents, and you can file for a protective order with one of those people there. So they'll hand you a piece of paper, and you go over in the corner, and you fill it out, and then you would go to court to see the judge. When we moved downtown, we changed that process. And so now that the court clerk's office and their staff understands the resources that we bring to the table to be able to help people, not just with protective orders, but with all of the other stuff that they need all at one time to be able to get through this particular incident, maybe prevent other incidents from occurring, they started referring all of the family violence, domestic violence cases to us if they showed up at the second floor at the county courthouse. So now they're saying, well, no, you need to go over here to the Family Safety Center. They will help you file your documents. They have other resources for you, and you should go there. So that immediately increased the numbers of people who were coming to us. But I think what else has happened is that we have done a much better job of getting word out about who we are and what we do. So while there are more calls for domestic violence response to 911, a lot of it is not because there's necessarily more violence or more families are engaging in it for a first time, but more people are calling who are aware that there is help and that they should call for help. So it sounds bad, but I think it's a good thing that there has been an increase, and we're seeing increased numbers come through our doors. Where we're seeing the significant increase is an interesting statistic in that 350 to 375 individuals every month are coming to us as first-time reporters. It's the very first time they've sought services at all, and that's new people every single month. So we've got about 100 to 150 who are returnees. They're coming back for additional services, or they have been in for services in the past and they have a new incident that's brought them back to us. So we're thinking that 300, 350 people as a baseline for new people every single month accessing services on the one hand is a good thing.
So in the sense then it's a recognition and an awareness issue, so that you don't necessarily know from data that there are more cases of domestic violence, but that there is more essentially self-reporting, people coming
through
the door.
There's more self-reporting. Yeah. There's more awareness that you don't have to stay in this relationship if it's a violent one.
And,
okay?
And
that
more
there
awareness
are help for that.
That this is a public health issue and,
exactly.
and a medical issue in addition to being a personal safety
issue. It is
issue.
A medical issue. And one of the things that we try to do, we do have a process when you come in, we'll have you do a brief health assessment. And if by doing this health assessment you answer yes to one of the first four questions, first thing you're going to do is see our nurse because we want to make sure that you're in good enough health to be able to do what you're going to do. So if you've got chest pain, if you're pregnant, if you're old, if you're bleeding, we're going to want to, or if you've been strangled, we're going to want you to go to the nurse immediately and have a very basic health assessment so that we can assure you and ourselves that you are physically able to continue on with your process. Because one of the things we know that happens with violence in families and individuals in particular is that your health changes, your health is affected, not just emotional health, your physical health is affected substantially by ongoing violence exposure. And that includes everything from high blood pressure to heart disease to diabetes to cancer. I mean, all of these different things that are really affected by the environment in which you live are actually now scientifically being proven to be affected by the violence that you're exposed to. And in children in particular, there's been so much research about trauma in children and how kids are affected by violence. You think, oh, well, that's an 18-month-old kid. They saw me slap him or her around a little bit. You know, that's no big deal. I don't understand what's going on. Those kids do understand what's going on. And their brains are affected because the whole mental process that they're going through of trying to cope with the stresses that they're feeling from the parents, with the situations that they're seeing, the emotional highs and lows. You've got kids in constant states of alert arousal for danger. And when that adrenaline continues to flow and continues to flow and continues to flow, it causes chemical changes in your brain that really can't be reversed. So you've got to get kids young. You've got to get them out of those situations. You need to get them into therapy. You need to get the parents to understand what's going on with the kids so that they can change their behaviors, because most people who are in those violent situations don't even think that it affects the children in any way, shape, or form because they didn't see it happen. They may have heard it. We had a really interesting case where a woman had come in. She was meeting with a nurse. She was severely beaten. She had an 11-year-old son. He was sitting out in the foyer He didn't want to go to the kids' room, so he was sitting in the foyer waiting for her, and I was talking with him. And I had overheard the mother telling the nurse that, yes, he was at the house. Oh, well, really, did he see the incident? Did he see his father beat you up? No. His dad only beats me on Wednesday nights. I make him go to his room at 5 o'clock so he won't see it.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay. Well, so this kid doesn't see it, but at 5 o'clock every Wednesday, he goes to his room because his father's coming home to beat up his mother. Now, I'm not quite sure if you would consider that traumatic or if you would think that child would be a victim to violence or that they would have any effects whatsoever from that. But when you stop and think about it, you're 11 years old and you just automatically go to your room at 5 o'clock every Wednesday because, gosh, that's, you know, dad beat mom night. So it's an intriguing thought process and treatment program that you have to get into with people who are in those situations to show that that is really not normal. You normalize behaviors, you rationalize behaviors because you live with it every day. And at some point, you reach a point where I can't live with that every day, but the damage is already done. So we have to figure out ways to mitigate that before it happens.
So of the clients that you see at the Family Safety Center, how many of them experienced abuse or neglect as children? In other words, how persistent is the cycle of violence running across generations?
It's pretty persistent. There is a test that was developed by Dr. Folletti called the Adverse Childhood Experience Test. It's a series of very simple questions, 10 questions, I think, and the actual test itself and Dr. Folletti's program was developed as part of the weight loss program for Kaiser Permanente in California.
In Southern California, yeah.
Yeah, and he was using this tool because he would have morbidly obese patients who would come in and they would lose 200 pounds. And it was very successful, and within a year and a half, they were back up to their 400 pounds. And he was trying to figure out why. What was the trigger that was making these people gain this weight back? So he developed this tool. And he thought, well, maybe it's something that happened when they were kids. So he started this testing process, and he found out that a lot of these patients were actually putting their weight back on because people were starting to approach them again, and they were feeling threatened. They were feeling like they were becoming abused again, and these people all had a history of child abuse. And so when you look at Oklahoma statistics, Oklahoma, it ranks number one for adverse childhood experiences in the country. So that means there aren't too many of us that haven't had something bad happen to us as children, whether it's divorce, whether it's drugs, whether it's an incarcerated parent, whether it's being neglected, whether it's being sexually assaulted, whether it's being physically assaulted. Those types of indicators, once you accumulate more than two or three of those, then chances are you're going to have some serious problems as an adult. We do know that one out of four kids who have been victims will become victims or abusers as adults unless there's some kind of treatment that will help mitigate that normalized behavior.
I want to ask you something else about the populations you serve. You have some really nice spreadsheets in your data pack, but one thing on what we call, or what you call, relationship to offender, I guess it maybe it shouldn't surprise me, but it sort of did, in that the numbers seem to indicate that the highest number of offenders are people who were in a former dating relationship, and that is seconded by current spouse, whereas there's a very small number of former spouses. So making that clear, I guess you have folks who are in a dating relationship, they break up, and then there's an incentive that was vastly the largest number.
Yes,
whereas in the
exactly.
spousal relationships, it was half as much, but again, in the current, the people actually married was much higher than in former spouses, where there was, I guess, finality of the relationship or court-based or legal
right.
finality.
Legal finality.
Yeah.
So a termination.
Termination. So what,
yeah.
what I mean, so
why
I guess,
is that?
Yeah, why is that?
You know, we have a lot of people that live together. They don't get married,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially younger people don't necessarily get married anymore. And even older people, if you've been divorced, and a lot of senior citizens don't remarry, even though they may cohabit, because of Social Security benefits and other things that they might lose if they were to marry their current partner. And so you have a larger percentage of the population who are living in those non-legally binding relationships as opposed to those who are married and who have a potential for divorce and leaving the relationship.
Where do you see the Family Safety Center going next? That is to say, if you've described to me how you're sort of at near capacity in terms of staff and this multitude of co-located services, what's your vision for the future of the organization?
Actually, 2 years ago, we started a process. We noticed the numbers that you've talked about, these 50%, 100% increase in capacity of people that were coming through the doors. And we thought, oh, my God, if this continues, we're going to have a real trouble. So we started a planning process 2 years ago. We worked very closely with Jan Feigert and Laura Ross-White at the Community Service Council, who worked with us and facilitated some strategic sessions, not just for our partner agencies, who include the police department, the DA's office and the courts, and the sheriff's department and DIVIS, Parent-Child Center, Tulsa Metropolitan Ministry, RSVP, the YMCA, YWCA, all of these different groups that we work with in partnership, but also those agencies who are in the same wheelhouse, if you will, of service to this particular population, Family and Children Services, EIS, some of these other organizations who are in the community. So we started a strategic planning process. We looked at a lot of the data coming out of Tulsa County on economy, on poverty, on marriage, on childhood adverse experiences, on high school graduation, teenage pregnancy, all of these different indicators, violence indicators, and looking at what we saw coming through our doors in terms of increased trauma, increased lethality of the violence, so much more serious injury, more strangulation or choking, as people would say here, more choking, more strangulation incidents. And decided, as science was also telling us, that, you know, we've been in the court advocacy piece for so long, literally walk in the door, get a protective order, do what you need to do, and then walk out and never knowing what happens to somebody. And we decided, we made a very conscious decision that we were never going to move the needle unless we started addressing prevention and intervention before an acute incident occurred. And so as we talked through that, then it became very clear that we needed to broaden our spectrum of services to start addressing what goes on with children and what goes on with elder adults, vulnerable adults, throughout the lifespan. And to do it, it was going to take more space to be able to handle a larger capacity of people coming to use a facility and more space to accommodate the needs of more service providers who would then toss their hats in to be able to provide wraparound services for people. So over the space of 2 years, we went through this process with all these different groups, and Jan and Laura and the Community Service Council stuck with us through the 2 years. And last summer, we actually came out with a five-year plan that would include additional services, a broader campus environment, a larger campus environment, meaning a standalone facility where we could do what we need to do the way we need to do it for best evidence-based practices and results, and who we needed to have at our table for the next level of development. What's happened since then is that we have a window of opportunity to really shrink that down as we have filled our space with our existing space with partners who are literally going to be sitting on top of each other, and our capacity of 50 to 60 clients plus their families and kids continue to increase, we've sort of truncated that plan down to maybe 3.5 years.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Suzanne Stewart is the Executive Director of the Family Safety Center here in Tulsa County. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. If you've missed any of our programs, you can always listen to them online on a smartphone, tablet, or computer. Just go to our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.